welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, June 15th. I'm Lori Blatchford, your reader for today, and here's our first story. Statehouse Leaders Haven't Determined Future of Virtual Participation by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Iowans for the first time had the option this year to observe and in some cases participate in all committee meetings during the legislative session, which was conducted amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Republican statehouse leaders say they have not yet determined whether those additions will become permanent in a post-pandemic world. As a way to help limit the number of people in the Iowa Capitol during the pandemic, statehouse leaders this year added live streaming video of all committee and subcommittee hearings during the 2021 session of the Iowa legislature. Previously, only floor debate was broadcast live. And the Iowa Senate, using Zoom, allowed Iowans to participate in subcommittee hearings. The Iowa House used a different streaming program and did not allow the public to participate virtually. The question is now whether those virtual viewings and participation options will remain if, during future sessions, the COVID-19 pandemic is not a public health concern. With their majorities in both the Iowa House and Senate, those decisions fall to Republicans, and leadership at the moment says nothing has been decided. Quote, "When we returned for the 2021 legislative session, we took many steps to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in the Capitol. Some of those efforts made us more efficient and more accessible to Iowans across the state. During the interim, we will look at what of those changes may be here to stay," said House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican from New Hartford, in a statement to the Bureau. Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, Republican from Ankeny, had a similar response delivered by his spokesman. "No decision has been made regarding whether streaming committees, subcommittees will continue next session in the Senate," the spokesperson said. "We will be spending the next several weeks getting feedback and will make a decision later this year." Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, Democrat of Coralville, said he hopes the virtual options, both for viewing and participating, are here to stay. Walls said he participated in multiple committee hearings from his office in the Iowa Capitol and his home in Coralville. Quote, "If you live in Des Moines, it's a heck of a lot easier to get over to the State House than if you live in Sioux City or Dubuque or Elkader or wherever," Walls said. "So in my opinion, having that virtual option for subcommittees is certainly worth exploring. I don't see really much downside," end quote. Perhaps one example of the downside to virtual participation from the public happened during a Senate subcommittee hearing when a virtual participant displayed an obscene image of male genitals. The meeting's moderator was able to remove the participant from the virtual meeting. The 2022 session will begin in January, but state lawmakers could need a short special session later this summer or fall to conduct the pandemic-related redistricting process. Gaming Expo Coming to Bluffs by Mike Brownlee of the Nonpareil staff. The Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs will be host to a gaming event in November. The Mid-America Gamers Expo will be held November 19th through November 21st at the center, one arena way, according to organizers. Quote, "The MAC will be transformed into a gamer's paradise with player-ready lighting, energizing music, and multiple food vendors. LAN, Local Area Network Party participants, from hobbyists to competitive gamers, are invited to bring their computers or consoles to participate in a variety of multiplayer games," organizers said in a release. A LAN party, LAN, features gamers gathering with their computers or consoles in the same physical space to play a game. The event is open to all ages and gamers and non-gamers alike. The sponsor is the Iowa West Foundation, and MAGE will feature three main components. A Gamers Expo with speakers, entertainment, and showcase for local and national sponsors and vendors who provide services and peripherals for gamers. A 26-hour LAN party with hundreds of gamers simultaneously playing multiplayer games across a private connection. And a tournament of champions featuring high school, college, and independent teams playing two different games for cash and prizes. Teams of four will face off in Call of Duty, and teams of three will face off in Rocket League, both head-to-head in a double elimination bracket. Former Nebraska and NFL football player Amon Green said local LAN party pros, NetWar, N-E-T-W-A-R, are a part of the organization of the event as well, along with partners Iowa Western Community College, 89.7 The River, the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce, and HERDAT. Quote, Iowa West Foundation launched MAGE to create a space and community for local and regional gamers, Iowa West Foundation President and CEO Brenda Mainwaring said in a release. This first-of-its-kind immersive experience will bring gamers, sponsors, developers, creatives, and exhibitors together in Council Bluffs. We are pleased to bring the region's first major esports event to the heartland, end quote. Tickets and entries for the tournament and LAN party will be available beginning in July and will include a variety of options including single day and weekend passes, LAN party admission, and tournament entry for two different games, the release said. Former Iowa DHS director files wrongful termination lawsuit by Rob Beauchart of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, Dateline Des Moines. A former state agency director is seeking his day in court, alleging he was wrongfully terminated by Governor Kim Reynolds and her staff in June 2019 for questioning the legality of using federal Medicaid funds in a salary dispute he sought to disclose to the Attorney General's office. Jerry Foxhoven, who served as Reynolds' director of the Iowa Department of Human Services for 2 years, has filed a lawsuit in Polk County District Court seeking financial damages for his wrongful discharge in violation of public policy that he claims occurred, quote, because he refused to engage in illegal activity, end quote, that amounted to, quote, committing Medicaid fraud and misuse of federal monies, end quote. The lawsuit filed against Reynolds, her chief of staff, Sarah Craig Gongel, and former legal counsel, Sam Langholz, contends a dispute arose over the continued DHS funding of a staff position within the governor's office that Foxhoven felt no longer fit the purpose under which the arrangement was originally made. Foxhoven said he questioned the legality of the ongoing agreement and stated he wanted an opinion from the Iowa Attorney General's office. Reynolds' staff requested his resignation before he could ask for that legal advice. The wrongful termination lawsuit alleges that Reynolds, Gongel, and Langholz, quote, terminated Foxhoven in order to prevent him from disclosing information he reasonably and in good faith believed constituted a violation of the law, mismanagement, a gross abuse of funds, or abuse of authority, end quote. According to the suit, Foxhoven was given no reason for, quote, his sudden and immediate termination, end quote, other than being told by the administration that, quote, we're going in a different direction, end quote. During a news conference days after Foxhoven's departure, Reynolds told reporters that many factors went into her decision and that she planned to take the department, quote, in a new direction, end quote. In his legal petition, Foxhoven contends the wrongful termination, which was, quote, willful and wanton, end quote, and done in, quote, reckless disregard of his rights, end quote, caused him to suffer and continue to suffering substantial loss of earnings and benefits, as well as emotional distress and damage to his reputation. He did not request a specific financial amount, but is seeking, quote, exemplary and punitive damages, end quote, and other compensations. In August 2019, Foxhoven filed a complaint against the state with the State Appeal Board seeking $2 million for wrongful dismissal. According to the board, the claim was withdrawn after a six-month tort requirement, so no legal action was taken by the state panel. Suspect in custody after allegedly setting woman on fire after altercation in Council Bluffs. This is by Mike Brownlee. Police have located and arrested a woman accused of setting another woman on fire. Lindsay Maves, 28, was taken into custody without further incident on Monday, the Council Bluffs Police Department said. She was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, first-degree arson, and willful injury. Maves is being held at the Pottawatomie County Jail. The jail booking website did not list a bond amount on Monday evening. Officers were called to New Visions Homeless Services in the 1400 block of North 15th Street just after 4:30 a.m. on Monday after an altercation between Maves and another woman. The altercation had occurred in the area but not at the shelter, according to New Visions director Brandy Waller. During the fight, Maves allegedly sprayed a flammable substance on the woman and lit her on fire, police said. As a third person at the scene tried to put out the fire, Maves allegedly continued to attack the victim, hitting her in the face with an unknown object, police said. Quote, "The woman that was injured walked to our shelter. She came to our facility to get help," Waller said. "We contacted police. She was in pretty bad shape. I'm glad we were here to help," end quote. The victim was taken to Nebraska Medicine for treatment. WOWT reported that she was taken to a burn unit in Lincoln, Nebraska. Police found Maves in an area not far from where the New Vision staff helped the victim. Sergeant Brandon Danielson said the arrest occurred around 3 p.m. in the area of 15th Street and Avenue M. Also on the front page today, a number of colorful photos, four colorful photos with the headline Pride 2021. These are photos by Joe Shearer, and there's a promise of more photos on page 2A, which I'll include here in this description, and also on the nonpareilonline.com. The caption reads, "Layla Carmen left and Christina Shanks blow bubbles while enjoying festivities at the 100 block party or block pride parade hosted by Caddy's Kitchen and Cocktails on Saturday. Members of the Council Bluffs Omaha metro area LGBTQ plus community and beyond, as well as friends, family, and allies, came together to celebrate LGBTQ plus Pride Month in style. At Wright, Anita H. Biscuit gets the party started during the Drag Yourself to Brunch showcase. Below left, Carrie Seibel wears rainbow shades and a rainbow ring while watching the show. And below left, Kaylee Ronfelt and Antonio Alvarez take in the atmosphere with their kids, Kiera and Xavier, age 3. On page 2A, there are two more photos. And the caption reads, "An American Sign Language interpreter signs as Tia Pett performs during the Drag Yourself to Brunch showcase at the 100 block Pride Party hosted by Caddy's Kitchen and Cocktails on Saturday." And then also we have a picture of Anita H. Biscuit, MC of the event, doing some crowd work between performances during the show. And this photo goes over the shoulder of the performer to a street that has many tables and chairs with people watching the show. Extra vaccine may help protect transplant patients. This is from the Associated Press. A small study offers the first hint that an extra dose of COVID-19 vaccines just might give some organ transplant recipients a needed boost in protection. Even as most vaccinated people celebrate a return to near normalcy, millions who take immune-suppressing medicines because of transplants, cancer, or other disorders remain in limbo, uncertain how protected they really are. It's simply harder for vaccines to rev up a weak immune system. Monday's study tracked just 30 transplant patients, but it's an important step toward learning if booster doses could help. It doesn't help everyone, but of the 24 patients who appeared to have no protection after the routine 2 vaccinations, 8 of them, a third, developed some virus-fighting antibodies after an extra shot, researchers from Johns Hopkins University reported in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The 6 others who'd had only minimum antibodies all got a big boost from the third dose. Quote, "It's very encouraging," said Dr. Dori Sevig, a Hopkins transplant surgeon who helped lead the research. "Just because you're fully negative after 2 doses doesn't mean there's no hope," end quote. Next up, working with the National Institutes of Health, Sevig's team hopes to begin a more rigorous test of a third vaccination in 200 transplants recipients this summer. For transplant patients, powerful immune-suppressing drugs prevent rejection of their new organs, but also leave them extremely vulnerable to the coronavirus. They were excluded from initial testing of the COVID-19 vaccines, but doctors urge that they get vaccinated in hopes of at least some protection. Some do benefit. The Hopkins teams recently tested more than 650 transplant recipients and found about 54% harbored virus-fighting antibodies after two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, although generally less than in otherwise healthy vaccinated people. It's not just a concern after organ transplants. One study of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and other autoimmune disorders found 85% developed antibodies, said Dr. Alfred Kim of Washington University in St. Louis. But those who used particular kinds of immune-suppressing drugs produced dramatically lower levels that are cause for concern. Quote, we tell our patients to act like the vaccine is not going to work as well as it does for their family and friends, said Kim, who would like to test a third dose in autoimmune patients too. This is very frustrating news to them, he said. Doctors sometimes give extra doses of other vaccines, such as hepatitis B shot, to people with weak immune systems. The guidelines issued in France recommend a third COVID-19 shot for certain severely immune-suppressed people, including transplant recipients, Segev noted. The U.S. hasn't authorized extra COVID-19 vaccines, but around the country, a growing number of immune-compromised patients are seeking third doses on their own. The people Hopkins sought to test. In San Francisco, Jillian Ladd agreed to blood tests before and after an extra dose. The recipient of a kidney and pancreas transplant, Ladd, 48, was terrified to leave her house after learning she had no measurable antibodies despite two Pfizer shots. With the additional dose, quote, I had gotten what I needed in order to survive, Ladd said, but she's still sticking with masks and other precautions. Quote, I am being as careful as I possibly can while acknowledging that I'm coming back into the world of the living, she said. Further research is needed to tell if a third dose really helps, who's the best candidate, and if there are brand differences, plus whether the extra immune stimulation could increase the risk of organ rejection. But Segev cautions boosters aren't the only possibility. In addition to antibodies, vaccines normally spur other protections, such as T cells, that can fend off severe illnesses. He and several other research groups are testing whether immune-compromised patients get that benefit. For now, the best, quote, the best way to protect these people is for others to get vaccinated, end quote, so they're less likely to get exposed to coronavirus, stressed Washington University's Kim. Father and son charged with storming Capitol January 6th. This is by the Associated Press. Dateline, Iowa City. The FBI on Friday arrested an Iowa man and his adult son after they discussed on social media their involvement in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, court records show. Daryl Johnson, 50, of St. Ansgar, and 29-year-old Daniel Johnson of Austin, Minnesota, were arrested separately by agents on Friday morning. An FBI affidavit quotes Daniel Johnson as writing, quote, we stormed Capitol Hill, end quote, to a contact on Facebook on January 6th. Quote, LOL, Dad and I were one of the first ones inside, end quote, his message allegedly said. The two made initial appearances in federal courts in Iowa and Minnesota, then were released from custody pending further proceedings in Washington, D.C. They are charged with entering and remaining in a restricted building, disorderly and disruptive conduct, violent entry, and parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building. Daryl Johnson declined comment when reached by phone Monday in St. Ansgar, a town of 1,200 where his father, Norman Johnson, is a former mayor and well-known businessman. Norman Johnson, who lost his re-election bid in 2019, also declined to comment on the arrest of his son and grandson. Quote, I have plenty of thoughts, but I'm not going to share them, he said. Investigators said they received tips that the Johnsons had been involved in the days after Supporters of former President Donald Trump violently broke into the Capitol and disrupted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory. One tipster, included a Snapchat video of Daniel Johnson, had allegedly uploaded showing himself inside the Capitol during the riot. Another included a screenshot of a Facebook post in which he allegedly wrote, quote, "I was one of the first ones inside the Capitol building," end quote. Daryl Johnson also wrote about the attack on Facebook, claiming the media narrative about what happened was wrong, according to the FBI. He claimed the protesters were peaceful until they were provoked by police throwing flashbangs and tear gas. Quote, "I was there, the media story is complete crap," he wrote. The FBI also found video from inside the Capitol showing the father and son walking through its halls together. A St. Ansgar police officer who is familiar with the family from Norman Johnson's time as mayor helped confirm Daryl Johnson's identity. Daryl Johnson is at least the sixth resident of Iowa to be charged in the January 6th riots. On the opinion page, this is titled, "Big Tech is Broken, but Can Congress Fix It?" This is by John Healy of the Los Angeles Times. Deputy editorial page editor and writer. The internet has been a great unifier, enabling people to join others around the globe in pursuit of common interests. And now the internet's largest platform operators, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google, are uniting Democrats and Republicans on the House Antitrust Subcommittee in pursuit of their common interest, reining in big tech's power. Members of the subcommittee on Friday introduced five bills, each with bipartisan co-sponsors, that aim to bar platform operators from using those platforms to benefit their other businesses and to increase competition in their markets. They zero in on some of the biggest problems these companies pose, but their proposed fixes are partial at best, not surprising given that they look at the companies through the lens of antitrust policy. For example, nothing in the bills would address the thorny speech-related issues raised by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, the complaints by Republicans that the platforms are censoring conservatives, and parenthetically it says a bias that some researchers have refuted, and by Democrats that platforms aren't doing enough to stop the spread of misinformation and hate speech. Nor would any of the bills provide a kind of privacy protection that California provides and that internet users throughout the country need. Nevertheless, each measure tees up a debate well worth having, and it's a shame that bipartisan bills like these are so rare on issues of this magnitude. Antitrust, in particular, should be a natural area of agreement between the parties. Generally speaking, Republicans want markets to work, and Democrats don't like big anything. It was the Reagan administration's Justice Department that broke up Ma Bell, after all. But the GOP has been conflicted, and in recent decades, Republican administrations pulled back on antitrust enforcement. Not that Democratic administrations have been much more effective when it comes to stopping big tech companies from buying up potential competitors. Witness how Obama administration greenlit Facebook's purchases of Instagram and WhatsApp. For my money, the most important of the five bills is the Augmenting Compatibility and Competition by Enabling Service Switching Act, because it would open a door to a flood of innovation in the fields now dominated by big tech companies. As Cory Doctorow has argued, the main barrier to competing with Facebook and other dominant social media companies isn't their scale. It's the inability to stay linked to the friends you've assembled on those networks when you move to a different service. The bill would require big tech platforms to enable users to securely transfer their data to competing platforms. Referring to Facebook as FB, in a post Friday about European regulations, Dr. O wrote, "With low switching costs, much of FB's monopoly protection evaporates. Lots of people hate FB, and FB knows it. You're on FB because your friends are there. Your friends are there because you're there. You've taken each other hostage, and FB benefits. With low switching costs, you could leave FB, but not your friends. The kill zone disappears. We all we need is interoperability," end quote. While the bill would require that data transfers be secure, however, That's a poor substitute for giving consumers privacy rights that protect their personal information. If lawmakers are serious about increasing competition, enacting a privacy bill of rights for internet users should be a prerequisite. Two other bills, the American Innovation and Choice Online Act and the Ending Platform Monopolies Act, try to address a significant anti-competitive problem that the subcommittee reported last year. They would bar big tech companies from leveraging their services to advance their own products and interests, potentially forcing companies to spin off some of their holdings. The prohibitions would reach such things as Google's use of its search results to favor its Google's services over its rivals, and parenthetically he writes, think Yelp and Kayak, and Amazon's use of data generated by third-party sellers in the Amazon marketplace to influence the products it develops under its own brand. The last two bills would expand the reach and enforcement of federal antitrust laws. The Platform Competition and Opportunity Act would bar big tech companies from snapping up nascent competitive threats, as Facebook famously did with Instagram in 2012. That's an intriguing idea, but it's incredibly expansive. Big tech companies would not only be barred from acquiring businesses that could reduce competition in their current markets, but also ones that could help them defend their current market dominance. That could conceivably bar big tech companies from branching into wholly new fields. And the Merger Filing Fee Modernization Act would require companies seeking approval for mergers and acquisitions to pay higher fees to the Federal Trade Commission while providing more money to antitrust enforcers at the FTC and the Department of Justice. Lawmakers have been sounding the alarm about alleged anti-competitive activity by big tech companies for years. Now there are some specific proposals to respond to those complaints. They're a long way from becoming law, but at least the first real step on that journey has been taken. All right, briefly, I want to run down the forecast. Sunny skies persist through Saturday in the metro. This is by Rachel George of the Daily Nonpareil. Warm sunny days continue throughout the week. Today's high is 92 with calm wind blowing southeast at around 6 miles per hour. Tonight's low is 65 with east-southeast wind of 3 to 5 miles per hour. A 30% chance of rain or storms is possible Thursday, followed by more clear sunny days. More rain and thunderstorms are possible Saturday night into Sunday throughout the day and evening. Today, sunny with a high near 92, calm wind, becoming southeast around 6 miles per hour. Tonight, clear with a low around 65, east-southeast wind, 3 to 5 miles per hour. Wednesday, sunny with a high near 94, south-southwest wind, 6 to 10 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Wednesday night, mostly clear, with a low around 71, south-southeast winds, 8 to 10 miles per hour with gusts as high as 16 miles per hour. Thursday, sunny and hot with a high near 100. Thursday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy with a low around 70. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 88. Mostly clear on Friday night with a low around 61. And that brings us to the middle, mid-break of our reading today of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, June 15th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader today, Lori Blatchford. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Jack Brian Conley, age 90, formerly of Council Bluffs, passed away on May 18th in Independence, Missouri. Born in Council Bluffs, Iowa on June 23rd, 1930, Jack was the son of Miles and Eunice Conley. He married Janice Bland Conley in 1950, together for 68 years, until her passing on July 28, 2018. Jack and Janice met at Abraham Lincoln High School. Jack graduated in 1949 and Janice 1950. They raised their three children in Council Bluffs and were members of the Community of Christ Church. Jack served in the U.S. Navy and was stationed in San Diego, serving aboard the USS Fort Marion, LSD-22. After the service, Jack graduated from Omaha University and the University of Virginia Graduate School of Banking. Jack was a highly professional banker for 50 years, beginning with Omaha's Northside Bank in 1952. He was a very community-oriented, service-minded person and an early proponent of CRA involvement, Community Reinvestment Act, providing banking services to those urban communities in Omaha. After Northside Bank, Jack moved to what became known as Hawkeye Bancorp, working for State Bank and Trust in Council Bluffs. He finished his career with Hawkeye, serving as president of Morningside State Bank in Sioux City. Jack, with wife Janice, moved to Tehachapi, California, in 1981 to start Sierra National Bank as president and CEO until his retirement in 2001. Jack was a highly engaged, civic-minded, and enthusiastic resident of Tehachapi for more than 30 years. His tireless support of the community and its people made him a well-respected pillar of the community. Jack was involved in many civic organizations and received many professional recognitions. He served as president of the Kern County Board and Trade and the Greater Tehachapi Chamber of Commerce. He was active in the Tehachapi chapters of Kiwanis Rotary and Optimist Clubs. He was a leader of Kiwanis International, receiving a variety of awards, including the International Foundation Hickson Fellowship. Jack was also a Boy Scout of America troop leader early on in his career, and later served as the Kern County Boy Scout Council on the Kern County Boy Scout Council. He received the Silver Beaver Award for outstanding lifelong service to the scout to scouting. Jack is survived by his three children, Patricia Kack, with husband Rod of Surprise, Arizona, Jim Connolly, with wife Linda of Independence, Missouri, and Becky Carter, with husband Dave of Tehachapi, California. He is also survived by grandsons Clint Brown, Brian and Brent Connolly, and David Carter, granddaughter Ashley Carter, and three great-granddaughters. Graveside services will be held for both Jack and Janice at 1:30 p.m. on June 21st in Council Bluffs, Iowa at Walnut Hill Cemeteries, Memorial Park. The family wants to thank the staff at Cedarhurst of Blue Springs, Missouri, and Lubincare Hospice for wonderful care they provided Jack during the last difficult years. Jack dearly loved his pets, most recently Rascal. Donations in Jack's memory can be made to the Midlands Humane Society, 1020 Railroad Avenue A, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503. Eunice Road, beloved grandmother, beloved mother, grandmother, sister, and aunt, passed away peacefully on May 31st at the age of 79. Eunice, formerly of Council Bluffs, Iowa, worked at Jenny Edmondson Hospital as a housekeeper for 21 years. Eunice enjoyed spending time with her family, gardening, and feeding the squirrels and birds. At the age of 9, Eunice dedicated her life as one of Jehovah's Witnesses. She remained faithful until the end. Eunice will be greatly missed. Memorial Talk will be held on Zoom on June 20th at 1 p.m. If you'd like to attend virtually, please contact the family at euniceroad@yahoo.com. euniceroad@yahoo.com for log on information. Mary K. Kathy Call, age 73, passed away Saturday, June 12th. Kathy was born May 24th, 1948. It was Kathy's wish to be cremated, and no service will be held. Richard George Wood passed away June 11th. He was born in Council Bluffs on August 5th, 1933, to parents Blanche Kinney and James Wood. He attended Abraham Lincoln High School in Council Bluffs and graduated in 1951. Soon after he started college, he decided to pause his studies to join the Army and serve in the Korean War, where he was stationed in Fort Ord, California, and later in Japan. After the war, he finished college at Omaha University and graduated in 1958 with a degree in business administration. On June 27, 1958, he married the love of his life, Rose Marie O'Brien. Richard and Rose Marie went on to have three children. Richard started his career in accounting, working for companies such as Swanson and Peet, Marwick, Mitchell, and Company. He advanced to earn his CPA and worked as controller of O'Keefe Elevator. In 1961, he started ABS Corporation manufacturing pet and equine products for veterinarians. Today, ABS Corporation is celebrating its 60th year in business and thriving under the leadership of his son, David. Preceded in death by his parents, James and Blanche Kinney Wood, and his sister Donna, Jean Wood Schultz, he's survived by his wife Rose Marie, Cookie, brother Gerald with Barb Wood, sister Sandra Lee with Fred Westfall, daughters Robin Lynn Wood with John, Verisette, Julie Ann Wood with Joel, Sure, son David George Wood with Deborah, and grandchildren Tad with Samantha Wood, Maya Wood, Wolfie Verestek, Betty Shear, David Shear, great-granddaughter Ophelia Rose Wood. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, June 17th, at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home in Council Bluffs. The funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, June 18th, at St. John Lutheran Church in Council Bluffs. Interment at Ridgewood Cemetery with military rites tendered by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. A lunch will follow at St. John Lutheran Church. Memorial contributions are suggested to St. John Lutheran Church or the Alzheimer's Association. All right, moving on to the sports page. Boys and girls tennis team up at state. This is by Peter Huguerin of the Nonpareil. A handful of local high school tennis players received a unique experience on June 8th when they competed in the Iowa High School State Co-Ed Tennis Tournament. The tournament is a doubles tournament with one boy and one girl per team. St. Albert sent two teams up with senior Jeff Miller and his sister, sophomore Landry Miller, making up one team, and juniors Allison Narmi and Carter White making up the other. Abraham Lincoln also submitted two teams. Seniors Harper Sneed and Dalton Pregan comprised the first team, and the second team was made up of junior Savannah Mazel and senior Carter James. Lewis Central took one team, sophomore Lainey Olson and freshman Christian Jensen. The Miller siblings won their opening match 6-love, 6-love over a team from Seidel and earned a second-round victory against a duo from Dubuque-Wallert, 6-2, 6-1. They lost to the eventual fourth-place finisher. Narmi and White lost in the first round of the tournament but won some exhibition matches afterwards. Quote, "It was a fun day where there really wasn't any coaching," St. Albert co-head coach Terry Miller said. "It was just really the kids playing each other and having a good time," end quote. The Lewis Central team of Olson and Jensen earned a victory in the first round, defeating a team from Ankeny 6-4 and 7-5. Quote, "They played great. They played the best tennis that they've been playing," Lewis Central head coach Aaron Rodenberg said. "We practiced for quite a while, and it showed that they were able to win in their first match." Neither team from Abraham Lincoln earned a win in the tournament, but Mazel and James won an exhibition match. Assistant coach Elena Zalar said it was a good farewell for three seniors. Quote, "It was a good experience," she said. "It was fun to get them that experience and seeing what co-ed doubles looks like." In prep softball, Ogden offense explodes against Lewis Central. Ogden softball found success early and often on Saturday against Lewis Central in the Woodward tournament, winning 9-3 after going 14-for-30 from the plate as a team. The Ogden Bulldogs hit two home runs and only struck out twice. The Titans led 3-2 after the top of the third when the Bulldogs scored 5 runs to take the lead for good. Ogden scored 1 run in each of the fourth and fifth innings. The Bulldogs scored 2 in the bottom of the first after a 2-run home run broke the scoreless tie. Matty Howard scored the first run for Lewis Central after hitting a 1-out triple and scoring on an error by Ogden. Haley Bach hit a leadoff home run for Lewis Central in the top of the third, and Paige Rodewald drove in Avery Heller on a double, who reached first after being hit by a pitch. Lewis Central's defense allowed Ogden back into the game, committing 6 errors compared to just 3 for the Bulldogs. The Titans finished with 6 hits as a team. Taylor Elam and Gracie Hayes both recorded hits as well. Lewis Central is in action next at 5:30 p.m. today on the road at Carroll Kemper. About the College World Series, the title of this article is Headed to Omaha, Field of 8 Set for College World Series. This is by Eric Olson of the Associated Press. North Carolina State, Texas, Tennessee, and Arizona locked up spots in the College World Series on Sunday, with the Wolfpack knocking out number 1 national seed Arkansas. 2 days after losing its NCAA Super Regional opener by 19 runs, Jose Torres hit a tie-breaking home run in the top of the ninth inning off SEC Pitcher of the Year Kevin Copps, and North Carolina State beat the Razorbacks 3-2 in the deciding Game 3. Tennessee defeated LSU 15-6, and Texas beat South Florida 12-4 to complete 2-game sweeps. Arizona won a 3-game series with a 16-3 victory over Mississippi. Virginia beat Dallas Baptist 4-0, and Notre Dame defeated Mississippi State 9-1 to force deciding third games on Monday. Number 2 Vanderbilt and number 9 Stanford were the first teams to claim spots in the CWS, which opens Saturday in Omaha, Nebraska. Two College World Series openers are set: North Carolina Stanford and Arizona Vanderbilt. Texas will play Notre Dame or Mississippi State, and Tennessee will face Dallas Baptist or Virginia. This marks the 21st straight NCAA tournament, and number 1 seed will not win the national title. It's the 8th time since the tournament went to its current format in 1999 that the top seed hadn't reached the College World Series. Arkansas, 51-13, had been the consensus number 1 team in the polls most of the season, hadn't lost a best-of-3 series since May 2019, and swept the SEC regular season tournament championship. But North Carolina State, with a 35-18 record, which lost 21-2 on Friday, held down the Razorbacks' potent offense while winning 2 straight one-run games in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Two pitchers held the Hogs to 4 hits in a 6-5 win on Saturday, and 3 pitchers combined to limit them to 4 hits again Sunday. Torres homered in all 3 games for the Wolfpack, who opened 1-8 in the Atlantic Coast Conference play and 4-9 overall. They made it to the ACC tournament final and were a number 2 regional seed in Ruston, Louisiana, where they swept 3 games by a combined 30-11. Quote, "They're a really good group of players and committed to one another," Coach Elliot Avant said. "They've been together and lived together 4 years now, and when you live together, go to class together, study together, and do all the social things, you become bonded. They believed early on when we were 1-8 that we could rebound, and they stuck with it, end quote. Arkansas coach Dave Van Horn made a surprising move when he gave Copps his first start of the season on Saturday. Copps had worked long, middle, and short relief for the Hogs this season, and hadn't allowed a run in 15 1/3 innings in regionals and super regionals. Quote, "We talked about how many pitches Kevin could throw, how many innings he could throw," Van Horn said. "Could we bring him in as early as the second inning? If we could, why not start him? He wanted to start, but that's what we did." Copps allowed Johnny Butler's 2-run homer and 6 other hits before giving up Torres's 9th-inning homer with his 118th pitch. Copps threw 324 pitches in 23 1/3 innings over 5 appearances in 10 days. Number 2 national seed Texas erased an early two-run deficit with four runs in the second inning and two more in the third to go up 6-2 against South Florida, and fans in Austin stood and shouted, "Omaha, Omaha," before the Longhorns got the last out. Texas, with a 47-15 record, will be making a record 37th College World Series appearance, and got a home run from Cam Williams and two doubles from Trey Faltine. South Florida was playing in its first Super Regional, advancing as a number 4 regional seed. Number 3 national seed Tennessee, with a 50-16 record, will head to the College World Series for the first time since 2005. Tony Vitello has established a strong bond with fans since he was hired 4 years ago, and the excitement level around his program is unprecedented. Quote, "I wanted to get this thing to where people were proud of it," Vitello said. "The crowd here and the people on the street speaks volumes to where it's at." After hitting no home runs in its 4-2 win Saturday, Tennessee continued its late season power surge. Jake Rucker went deep twice, and the Vols matched their season high with 6 homers, increasing their NCAA tournament total to 16 in 5 games. Number 5 Arizona, with a 45-22 record, will be in the College World Series for the 18th time. They scored 7 runs off 3 pitchers in the 4th inning to break open the game. Ole Miss started its closer, Taylor Broadway, and he left after giving up Ryan Holgate's homer and 2 singles to open the 4th inning. The Wildcats' 16 runs were the second most allowed by Ole Miss in 115 all-time NCAA tournament games. Virginia's Griff McCary struck out 7 in 7 in or struck out 10 in 7 innings, and combined with Brandon Neek and Kyle Witten on the 4-hit shutout in Columbia, South Carolina. The Cavaliers, who are 34-25 record, scored all their runs in the 8th inning against the Patriots, who were 41-17, with Zach Geloff leading off with a homer and Alex Tappan hitting a 3-run homer. David LaManna's 3-run homer in the 4th inning broke the game open for Notre Dame, which has a 34-12 record. Aiden Tyrell held host Mississippi State with a 44-16 record to 1 run on 5 hits in 7 and a third innings. Vanderbilt, with a 45-1 record, and Stanford, 38-15, had already locked up spots in the 8-team field on Saturday with 2 game sweeps over East Carolina, 44-17, and Texas Tech, 39-17, respectively. Vanderbilt won 4-1, while Stanford won 9-0. Vanderbilt pitcher Jack Leiter started the game on the mound and pitched 7 innings. He limited ECU to 1 run on 2 hits while striking out 10 batters. Stanford also won with a dominant pitching performance. Alex Williams pitched all 9 innings, where he held Texas Tech to no runs on 2 hits while striking out 10. Virginia locked up its spot in the College World Series with a 5-2 win over Dallas Baptist on Monday. Dallas Baptist held a two to nothing lead after 3 innings, but Virginia rallied in the 7th, scoring 4 runs off a grand slam from Kyle Teal. Mississippi State clinched the last spot in the tournament on Monday night with an 11-7 victory over Notre Dame. Mississippi State took an early lead after scoring 6 runs in the 2nd inning and never trailed. So there we got the update of Monday's games at the end of this article. I'm sorry I didn't know that earlier on. I could have updated that earlier part of the article. So Virginia is in, and so is Mississippi State, to join the others. Rebrocha isn't Garza, but there are similarities. This is about Iowa basketball. This is from Don Doxies of the Quad City Times. See if any of this sounds vaguely familiar. There is this young basketball player of Eastern European descent who has a center-sized body but a perimeter mindset. He doesn't want to be typecast as a post player. He wants to do a little bit of everything on the court. He has a father, who is a pretty good player himself, who takes an intense interest in his son's development, talking to him nearly every day about work ethic and practice habits. Luca Garza, right? But it's also Philip Rebrocha. Rebrocha arrived in Iowa City last week as one of the newest members of the University of Iowa basketball team, following three very productive seasons at the University of North Dakota. He figures to step into most of the minutes played by Garza during the past couple of seasons, and while it would be wildly unreasonable to expect him to be anywhere near as prolific as Garza was, there are definitely similarities between the two. Rebrocha, and it's spelled R-E-B-R-A-C-A, is a 6'9" center who doesn't just plant himself in the low post and stay there. He attempted 78 three-point field goals and handed out 100 assists in 87 games at North Dakota. Quote, "It's what I pride myself on, doing a little bit of everything," Rebrocha said. Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey sees it that way, too. He describes Rebrocha as, quote, "a perfect fit for our transition and our motion game. He's a really skilled 6'9 guy that can rebound, can handle it, can shoot it, and drive it. He can pass. He gives us a lot of versatility," McCaffrey said. "I think I want him to be a guy that is not a straight five. He'll play the five a lot, but he'll be out on the perimeter," end quote. When Rebrocha was looking to leave North Dakota as a graduate transfer after last season, he wanted to go to a school that had a quality master's program in finance and a fast-paced scoring offense. He also wanted to go to a slightly larger community with a better climate. Iowa checked all the boxes, even the weather one. Subscribe today and support local journalism. "I will never forget the winters up there," Rebrocha said of North Dakota. "It's probably the most brutal thing I've ever experienced. Remind us not to book any January vacations to Grand Forks." One suspects it was the offense employed by the Hawkeyes and the way they utilized Garza the last few years that was the biggest lure. Quote, it's a very free-flowing offense," Rebrocha said. "Everyone is engaged. Everyone has a role to play. Everyone can make decisions and make plays. I wanted to go to a place where this is the case because I think this is the best and most fun brand of basketball." Like Garza, Rebrocha also is heavily influenced by his father. Zeljo Rebrocha was a European superstar in the 1990s and a 5-year NBA veteran, and he talks to his son on the phone nearly every day. Quote, "He's always telling me I need to be in the gym 24/7, Phillips said. "If I've been in the gym for 3 hours, he'll tell me, back in the day, I was in the gym for 4 or 5 hours. If I've been in the gym for 4 hours, he's been in the gym for 8 hours. He's always just telling me that hard work is the way to go," end quote. Phillip is a very interesting kid with a uniquely diverse background. He was born in Italy, where his father played for the famed Benetton Treviso team, then moved to Greece, where his dad was MVP of the EuroLeague. Jelko Rebrocha decided to take his shot at the NBA, so the family was off to Detroit and then Los Angeles. Then it was back to Serbia. Philip finished high school in Colorado, attended prep school in Massachusetts, and then spent those 3 years trying to stay warm in North Dakota. He is equally fluent in English and Serbian. He has only a trace of an accent, and also can read and understand Italian, although he doesn't speak it very well. Oh, and he has this friend back in his hometown of Sambor, Serbia, who he sometimes spends time with, some guy named Nikola Jokic. Quote, "When I go back to Serbia, he's sometimes there in the summer and we see each other," Rebrocha said of Jokic, a Denver Nuggets star who was named MVP of the NBA last week. "I don't want to say we're best friends, but we always see each other and we talk about how we're doing and whatnot. When we were younger, we used to practice together during the summer." Rebrocha admits that Jokic is, quote, "a once-in-a-generation player," end quote. But he added that, quote, "I would say maybe some of my post moves resemble his," end quote. A word of caution, do not expect Rebrocha to be Nikola Jokic or Luka Garza, but he probably is going to be Iowa's starting center next season. He's a near lock to beat out sophomore Josh Ogudeli, freshman Riley Mulvey, and sophomore Chris Murray, who McCaffrey said is likely to play some center despite being hit a bit undersized for the position. And although he is a graduate transfer, this probably is not going to be just a one-year fling in Iowa City. Quote, "The plan is to be here 2 years because this is a 2-year master's program, and I don't want to leave things unfinished," Rebrocha said. So my plan is 2 years, but if I have an exceptional season and I have an opportunity to go play pro and earn a lot of money, I guess it's something you always have to take into consideration. But I'm probably leaning towards staying here 2 years." End quote. One final item today, under the title Do Just One Thing. Gas prices are escalating at an alarming rate, so today is the day to do everything you can to help make your car as efficient as possible. Check the trunk and back seats for unnecessary items that are adding weight to the car and remove them. Take your car to the gas station and make sure the air pressure in all of your tires is at the recommended level. Add air if needed. And always completely fill up the fuel tank each time you visit the gas station. The fewer trips you need to make there, the more miles per gallon you can add to your overall bottom line. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, June 15th. I'm your reader, Lori Blatchford. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and have a great day.